Hello, everyone. My name is Jacob Minig. I am the host of the Behavioral Health Integration Podcast. On this special episode, I want to do something a little bit different. Today, I would like to go over a book. It is a very special book to me. I really learned a lot. The book is called Wasted, An Alcoholic Therapist's Fight for Recovery in a Tragically Flawed Treatment System by Michael Pond and Maureen Palmer. Now, the majority of this book is based on Michael Pond. He's the therapist in this book, going through his story of recovery and how he got started in the system, how he had to overcome many, many sickening barriers in our, again, flawed system. And this book is actually taking place in Canada. So for us American listeners, we're going to get a good viewpoint on the Canadian behavioral health system, and we can kind of compare it to ours and what are the pros, cons, and again, just hear this man's tremendous recovery story. So to get started, I will read majority of the book. I'll go through certain sections and I'll read and review his story, and I'll give my thoughts based on his experiences and kind of how I feel about certain situations. And what I would like to do at the end of each episode is put like a drop-down questions or give my listeners a chance to make comments on the episodes that I kind of read them. So again, I'll go through the story. I won't go through obviously every word of the book, but I'll go through certain sections and then stop and review what I think about these certain situations. So let's get started. Part 1. The Couch of Willingness. Chapter 1. 3 Mile Beach. So in the beginning of the chapter, it starts out with Michael Pond and his girlfriend Dana in jail. And then it kind of does like a flashback earlier in the day when they're on the beach. So I'll just start from the part when they're on the beach and go from there. 3 Mile Beach in light Sovereignty. So magical. It's a rare kind of day. Mr. Pond, Dana emerges from the lake, runs across the sand, and stands before me, glistening in the sun. Let's move to Nelson and open up a treatment center on the lake. It is our destiny. We're meant to do something amazing together. I gaze into Dana's piercing blue eyes. I'm sick with longing. I long for her and the fantasy we've built together. A fantasy so flimsy, I really feel it slipping away. She arranges her perfect coral bikini-clad body on the towel, plants a kiss on my sun-burnished brow, lies down next to me. At 42, Dana's lithe, willowy beauty belies her. I've always wanted to open up a treatment center. I've been practicing psychotherapy for 20 years in this area in Pensatone. So to my listeners, this is again Michael Pond just on the beach relaxing, kind of just thinking about the fantasy of opening a treatment center. Michael Pond then goes and just contemplates all the people that he's pretty much ever helped, all the people with mental health issues, alcohol issues, that he was able to get sober and everything. And he's just kind of thinking to himself right now in his head, but, you know, I can't help myself. It's weird. You know, I help others, but I can't help myself get into sobriety. Then he goes to Dana and says, yeah, the universe has a grand plan for us all. You know, he tries to sound excited about the idea, but again, he kind of just realizes it's just more of a fantasy than ever, you know. Dana exhales, her face breaking into a wide smile. Her perfect white teeth dazzle. I smell vodka. The fantasy then fades just a little bit more, and then over the course of the afternoon at the beach, we polish off a liter of a half of Smirnoff mixed with orange juice and a splash of Frank's hot sauce. We relax, and then we are, again, just two drunks on the beach. Micah Pond then gets into explaining how this area is just known as wine country, but we don't drink wine. One would have to drink too much and wait too long for its effect. Vodka is a much more efficient drunk. And after going hard at it for nearly a month, we are all about efficiency around here. Forget wild sexual attraction, stimulating conversations, shared values and beliefs and interests. What keeps me and Dana together now is booze. Every encounter plays out in the same sickening sequence, from the first seductive sip to giddy intoxication, then through belligerence and anger and exaggerated competence to depression and sullen self-pity, ending finally at self-loathing. Dana announces, "Mike, I want my kids to meet you." She gets up off her towel, brushing sand from her bare legs. They're actually not far away. Then Mike, saying, "My judgment dulled by Smirnoff, I actually agreed to this absurd idea." "Who wouldn't want to meet Mom's drunken boyfriend?" he says. Now we are into chapter 2, The Visit. As they're driving along, Dana intentionally drives slower than the speed limit just not to alert cops. Late afternoon October sun still warms our shoulders as we cruise up the lake shore in our little Mazda Miata MX-5. We travel through the area, curve around the base of the Munson Mountains, and to the Narmada Road. Then Michael starts thinking and saying, "Dana, I just don't think this is a good idea. We just turn back, drop me off at my place." Dana, "Oh no, I want you to meet them." Dana then focuses on the road ahead. "I'm so proud of you." "Oh," Mike's saying, "I'm not proud of me, I'm a drunk." We pull up to the 1960s two-story looking house, and I'm just starting to get nervous. A sense of Dana is currently separated from her husband right now, and she has two sons. According to Mike, Dana's husband sounds like a decent guy. He lets Dana drop by whenever she wants to see her sons. I'm not sure, again, how he's going to feel about us showing up at his house. Then Dana slithers out of the driver's seat and staggers to the front door as they arrive. Her 9-year-old son, just home from school, spies us first as we step into the house. He runs up and hugs Dana. Her older son walks in, and he and his brother exchange anxious, "Here we go again," glances. Ouch. My presence seems to barely register in their eyes, which I am relieved. My stomach knots and my jaw clamps. My eyes dart around the room. God, I just wish I was invisible right now. At this moment, I'm trying to sober up quickly, but Dana, she just keeps drinking. She just keeps drinking vodka and orange juice. She emerges from a bedroom. Her drink just miraculously fills up, refreshed. She's just got a stash everywhere. Under different circumstances, I would just consider that one of her major attributes. Dana stands at the sink, washing dishes. I keep thinking in my head, I should not be here. I need to get out of here. The two boys sit back on the couch, their eyes scanning back and forth from their mother to me and to the door, hoping for a miracle to walk in and happen. I then lean back on an old easy chair. Finally, Dana's 12-year-old son speaks in a tone and manner that children of alcoholics learn early. "Don't want to set Mom off, but Mom, maybe it would be better if you just came back later." He and I lock eyes. I detect fear, disgust, and anger. I look away. I say to Dana, "Dana, let's go," I urge. I take her by the elbow and guide her towards the door. Too late. Dana's estranged husband appears in the doorway. He takes in the scene. I see on his face that the odd blend of shock, but calm at the same time. Dana then explodes, saying, "You useless prick!" Her face contorts with rage. "I hate you." Sean, the husband, clearly practiced at this, sits down at the kitchen table. "Dana, you're drunk. Why don't you guys just leave right now?" Dana screaming, "You prick. You useless piece of shit. Sean then turns in his chair to face Dana and places both of his hands on the table. The boy is scrunched closer together on the couch. My mouth hangs open in shock. I have never heard my Dana talk this way. Dana, let's go. The fingers on my left hand press against her upper arm. Let's go. Let's get out of here. With brute strength, she wrenches free and lunges towards a knife right on the counter. She says, not until I kill this limp dick prick. She wraps her fingers around the blade. In my head, there's no time to process this. As they jump into action. No, Mom, no. Dana's older son pleads with her. Please, just leave, just go. Sean, the husband, then grabs a chair and holds it in between himself and Dana, just like a lion tamer. I then dive for Dana, grab her wrist, and wrench the knife from her hand. Dana, let's go, that's enough. I toss the knife back on the counter. Dana wrestles and kicks me as I drag her out the door. They all stare after us in the part disbelief, part relief. My mind reels. God, what the hell just happened? What happened to my Dana? Who is this woman? I then hear Sean on the phone behind us calling 911. We bolt for what is now our gateway car. We jump into Dana's car. Dana tears out of the driveway, spraying gravel everywhere, cursing and yelling the fucking male-dominated world, she says. I can't take my eyes off her. I still can't believe this is the same Dana. As we drive along the road, I'm closer to sober than she is, but she still has a driver's license. Mine was suspended. I picked up my first impaired driving charge a few months ago. It was 9 a.m. on the way to the liquor store. My second impaired charge came the very next day, also at 9 a.m. on the way to the same liquor store. Then a few weeks ago, I passed out the wheel and slammed my brand new Honda Ridgeline headlong into a wall of rock. It was my 55th birthday. I'm riding shotgun for God knows how long. We then end up at the edge of a cliff. The whole scene is unreal. I just think Thelma and Louise in the British Columbia tourism ad. We teeter at the edge of the cliff. Her bloodshot eyes glare straight ahead at nothing. They scare the shit out of me. A few months ago, I fell in love with those eyes. It was a bright July day. I had taken my lunch break at Three Mile Beach. I was sitting, staring out at the water, washing down my wrap with a Smirnoff cooler, when out of the sudden corner of my eye, I spied legs. Long, tanned legs. I tracked them up as they disappeared below a flimsy apple green sundress. She looked at me and smiled, then turned away. With a bounce of her dark red curls, I watched her for the next few minutes. She kept glancing back. I looked behind me to see if she was trying to look at someone else, but there was no one there, no one else on the beach. I downed the last swig of the cooler, and with all the swagger in my 5'6" body I could muster, I walked across the sand and introduced myself. Dana, she replied, and reached out and shook my hand. She let me know that she was getting divorced. She's moved up to the area, and she's getting a fresh start. At the time, she was managing her friend's B&B. I let her know, too, that I was also getting divorced. But I can't even get my act together to make that happen. We agreed to meet for coffee the next morning. That was the first and last coffee we ever had together. We immediately switched to the hard stuff. Dana's a drunk like me. Fuck. Dana squeezes the steering wheel. I hate that prick. He called the cops. At this moment, I need to take charge because I am closer to sober. I ease open the passenger door. God, I hate heights. I shuffle out of the car. I lean back as if I were leaning forward would send me cascading over the edge. I peer down just enough to see the lake. I edge back and around the rear of the car to the driver's side and swing open the door. I yell, get out, I'm driving, you're going to kill someone. No, fuck, I'm driving. I still have a license, you prick. Dana stares out the windshield. How did I so quickly become a prick in this moment? I then shove her towards the passenger side. She arches over the shifter, She then glances my way and then out the window. I then climb into the driver's seat, press the brake. I shift the Miata into reverse. I slowly back away from the edge of the cliff and turn the car around. We don't get far before I just hear it. I hear the faint wail of police sirens echo up the valley as the Miata squeals into the pavement onto the main road. I then look in the rearview mirror and see three cop cars speeding up on us. I think to myself, should I outrun them? Then I have a sober thought telling myself, pull over. So I did. The officers haul us out. They splay us spread-eagled over the trunk of the patrol car and search us down, and then handcuffed us. The officers put us in the cop cars and then drive us off. We're heading to the drunk tank. Chapter 3. Bonnie and Clyde go to jail. Frank is the processing officer tonight. Shit. We played on the same hockey team for years together. Our sons play hockey together. Ever since they were toddlers. Countless times over the countless beers we've engaged in. We've bunked together for trips, played poker into the wee hours in the night, carrying along like old buddies. We are old buddies. But tonight, Frank, the cop, he's all business. He ushers me into the back room, sits me down in front of the breathalyzer, tells me to blow. I know and he knows that I'm over the legal limit, way, way over the legal limit. He takes my fingerprints. He then takes my mugshot. As he fills in the requisite forms, Frank then pauses, looks at me, and says, please get some help, Mike. His pen hovers over the form. You've got to stop. You're really needed in this community. Thanks, Frank. I will. I hang my aching head. I know I won't. Just not today, anyways. I need a drink. My eyes are down. I shuffle into my cell. The door slams behind me. A sour stench assaults my nose. A blend of vomit, bleach, and urine and sweat lingers in the air. I hurl myself towards the center jail issue-stained steel toilet and just make it out. I retch and vomit and retch and vomit and dry heave again and again until I can't no more. In just a few hours, Blessed Dawn will save me from this hellhole. We'll get sprung. The liquor store will be open. I'll get my medicine, and the shakes will stop. I peel myself off the floor and collapse onto the bed. Cold, battleship-grade, painted metal, with a 1.5-inch thick black plastic mat, like the ones you use at the gym to do sit-ups on. I pull the blanket over my aching body, aware of the rush of the red heat, up the sides of my neck, delivering guilt, shame, then self-loathing. With most of the alcohol purged out of my body, I contemplate this disastrous turn of events. Dana is in charge with the uttering threats. I have a third impaired charge, 3 impaired driving charges. I could have killed someone. When working with clients who have driven drunk, I've always dispassionately wondered, how can anyone in this day and age drive drunk? Well, now I know. I think to myself, how will I ever look at my 3 sons in the eyes again? Especially Taylor, my oldest. He took on the burden of preventing me from driving drunk. He developed a sixth sense, anticipating the moment before the alcoholic's judgment gives out and the grandiose sense of self kicks in. The very last moment, when I still had a single shred of good sense, he'd show up and demand that I hang over the car keys. A few days later, he'd show up and hand them back, knowing he'd have to do it all over again in the next few days. The last time he knocked on my door, I was deep in DTs, detoxing, and he sat at the foot of my bed for hours to see me through it. It's going to be okay, Dad, he would tell me. You're going to get through this. You need some Tylenol? And you get some more water, Dad. Once healthy enough to walk in a swift betrayal of his compassion, I immediately shuffled down to the Bubbly's, my favorite liquor store. I then stocked up on Smirnoff, then headed home. When I was deep in my bender, Taylor showed up just a little late. I was so drunk, there was nothing I couldn't do. I refused to hand the keys over to Taylor. He wrestled them from me and took them from my hands, then staring at me. Something in my eyes changed. He tossed the keys on the kitchen counter and walked out the door. Not so long ago, my three boys were the center of my life. So for the listeners and everything, he's just more reminiscing about just the past and what he really did to get here. As Mike is in jail now, he's sitting contemplating his life right now. And he's just really thinking about all kind of like the negative things that are happening to him. So with all of his drinking infractions, you know, he's thinking in his head right now, God, I'm going to lose my driver's license for life now. And worse, I'll lose my license to practice therapy. My hands vibrate. God, I'm going to be sick. So at the police station, they release us at 8:37 in the morning. 23 unbearably long minutes until the liquor store opens. The car impounded, we walk arm in arm. More just to hold each other up than out of affection. We head straight to the liquor store. We sit in silence on the curb in front of the liquor store. It's not cold, but we both shiver. Shoppers heading into the Safeway chute, condemning looks coming our way. Someday soon, we'll have our day in court. But today, the party continues. We then get our alcohol and then take a cab back to my place. We take the cab to a little bungalow that I share with a brain-injured Todd. He's a friend who knew I was just down on my luck, and I knew Todd needed a company, so we figured we'd make a good pairing. His house was within two blocks of three liquor stores, the home that is a metaphor for what my life has become. Chapter 4, Getting Here. So early in Chapter 4, he starts talking about where he mostly spends his time, where he lives, and that there's like a main street called like Government Street, and that's where he has his office for his therapy clients. And then he also gets into just the fact that he thinks about just the audacity, how he could still see clients when he is doing all this drinking and getting to these legal issues. He now has to ride a bike to work. And again, just the fact that he's not in a good state of mind and still practicing therapy to clients. So he then starts talking about one day he was riding his bike, you know, and one of his son's buddies called out to him, and he was just really embarrassed to like stop. But he does, and he tries to like make the conversation really quick, and like he just asks the guy, "Hey, how you doing?" And they just start talking, and then he makes up an excuse to like leave, and in shame, he just realizes after he's like leaving everything that he only has one shoe on. And then his other hand is a liter of alcohol. And then as he just tries to ride away, just thinking about what his son's friend is thinking of him right now, you know. And then he gets into reminiscing about a photo in his office, you know. He says, you know, there's a photo of me from the day that I got my master's degree in social work. And just how proud he was and his family was of him for making that accomplishment. He then gets into the long nights of studying and doing homework for school, all the all-nighters he pulled in the library, the graveyard shift, at the juvenile services. You know, he just would spend all this time, you know, cramming, sleep deprived, filling his head with information on Adler, Ellis, Young. He's just so tired, you know, he just remembers all the hardships he's faced to getting that graduate degree. He then starts getting to the thesis time for his grad school. So as thesis time approached, I could not keep up with the punishing workload. On the final weekend the thesis was due, on a Monday morning, I wrote around the clock. Up in the kitchen cupboard, tucked in the back of my mind, a full bottle of Bacardi white rum. Sunday at noon, it whispered to me. I ignored it. By 10 p.m., I was positively vibrating with anxiety and anticipation. With the boys and Rhonda in bed, I clambered to the cupboard and broke the seal and the booze and the prose flawed. I finished the bottle and the thesis off at 5 a.m. in the morning. I fell asleep on the couch. Rhonda quietly got the boys up and hushed them off to school, where she worked as a teacher's assistant. Almost noon, I woke up to find the empty bottle of Bacardi tucked in beside me on the couch. I wrenched it out with a little too much force, and it flung past me to shatter on the floor. Shit! Shards everywhere. I rushed to pick them up, cutting my feet in the dash to the kitchen for the dustpan. Blood gushed and puddled on the floor and oozed out over the edge of the white dining room carpet. I then fell asleep again and woke up at 3:30 p.m. I glanced at the clock in shock. I realized the kids were about to be home any second now, but it was too late. My 10-year-old son, Taylor, stood at the end of the couch and looked at me, confused and afraid. "Dad, are you okay?" he said. "There's blood on the carpet, and your foot's bleeding." "Yeah, I'm just not feeling very good. And, you know, I accidentally broke a glass. It's okay. You go upstairs and play." I then cleaned up the mess before Rhonda got home with the younger boys. I then felt guilty, and I decided to take Taylor to McDonald's. As he stuffed his face with the Big Mac, I started to talk to him. And I said, "Did it scare you when you saw me like that?" "Yeah, Dad, it did. It scares me when you get drunk." I then said, "It will never happen again, Tay, I promise. I don't want to scare you or your brothers or your mom." I hugged him, softly rubbed his back, and then told him, "I love you, son." We chowed down our meals, and I vowed myself that this has been my last bender ever. When we got home, I told Rhonda right away that I'm going to AA, and then she was relieved. Just the fact that passing out in front of Taylor scared me into action. I then finally went to my first AA meeting, but I wasn't like those people. They were drunks, all right? I sat through the entire meeting without saying a word. As I left, an old fellow says, "If you're thinking about drinking and thinking about not drinking, you're an alcoholic." I didn't want to admit yet just how much my thinking revolved around drinking. In 1995, I got my master's degree. I quit my government job, cashed in my pension to set up my private practice. "Stay the course, Michael." That was my saying. That was the audio playing in my head constantly. Just stay the course. Every time I felt the urge to drink, I went mountain biking or played hockey or snowboarded with the boys. Or just worked more, you know. In 1996, my practice took off. Each successful relationship built with a client began several more. By 2000, after a few years after favorable word of mouth, the agencies came calling. The Workers' Compensation Board, Health Canada, Social Services, the Insurance Corporations of British Columbia, the RCMP's Victim Services, the school boards, and the Indian boards. The lucrative contracts meant I could hire staff. At the peak in my early 2000s, we had four counselors and an office manager working for Michael Pond Associates, Ltd. As the business took off, so did our social lives, which swirled around hockey. Every day, the boys practiced. We had our games. I would actually play hockey 3 times a week with my buddies, most of us dads with our kids in the hockey league. After game, we'd all go for beers and nachos at the local bar. The weekend shifts to the boys' games. We'd be cradling our beers. All the dads screamed support to their sons and heckled the refs. After the games, we would go to a party at the house. At this time, the parents would get plastered drunk. 3 beers became 4. And again, I'm not alone in all this. We all drink too much. We all laugh too loud. We egged each other on. They'd say, "Come on, Mike, have a rum and coke. Hey, try this new martini." Every winter weekend would become a social event, sanctioned bender. When summer arrived, we switched to barbecues. Living in the heart of the wine country, Friday through Saturday, then Sunday, became one extended wine tasting contest. When everyone else would sip wine, I pounded them back. I drank faster than everyone else. Only when everyone else was feeling a light buzz, I felt nothing. And after a half dozen glasses of wine, I became the life of the party. Or so I thought. "Oh, Mike, you were so funny last night," they would say. But during the weekdays, I still function. Up at 5 a.m., I take the boys to hockey, go for a bike ride, get to the office by 7, do reports and invoices. I'll see clients, go home, enjoy a rum and coke with my wife, put the kids to bed, and then have a few more rum and cokes. I'll say to myself, "Hey, I can handle this." Then 2001. More warning signs started to creep in. I began to start creating little stashes of gin in the garage and on the new boat. In the summer of 2001, I counted at least 20 wine tasting parties I went to. I go to the parties, then come home and hit my stash. The audio loop was now, "Hey, buddy, don't you think you should better cut back?" But I don't want to stop. I can't stop. Alcohol is woven into everything that gives me life and gives me meaning. My boy's sports, my evening kickbacks with the rum and cokes and Rhonda, the warmth and security of belonging to a tight-knit group of friends, intimacies shared, relationships forged over success, and can you think of a worse place in Canada to live for an alcoholic than my city? I mean, how many times did Rhonda and I mix up gin and tonics and cart our lawn chairs down to the shore of the lake to just watch the sunset? I can't give that up. As my drinking wraps up, my practices increasingly focus on dealing with alcohols and devastating impacts they would face. I sat on two boards for Victim Services and the Brain Injury Society, and I would counsel those who've been survived by a catastrophic crash where a drunk was at the wheel. I would look down at my notes, and at one meeting, my hand is so vibrating and shaking so badly I can't even read my own handwriting. Referrals from the Ministry for Children and Family Development brings broken families, many of them from the First Nations, often involve sexual abuse. That was actually my thesis that had been written by myself. My thesis had been a treatment outcome study of adolescent sexual offenders, so I was well equipped to deal with this kind of trauma, or so I thought. So at this point, Mike's trying to tell us about all the major stress that he goes through with his job. Just hearing about just the traumatic incidences that would happen with these families, with the sexual abuse, the murders, and this would go on every day for him, you know. So he would just explain further how he would just sometimes leave work and he would start drinking, and that would be the only thing that would really take his edge off of all this stress, you know. So that was kind of like his stress reliever. But unfortunately, people started to catch on about Mike's drinking. They tried to throw him a lot of warning signs, but he just couldn't quite get it. You know, he would just tell himself, you know, how can I hold it together? But each time he just could not do it. The superintendent of the school district gave me several warnings before pulling the contract. Even one of the school counselors said, "God, you're more fucked up than the families we send to you, Mike. God, get help." A client from one of my employees' assistance program contracts came to my office and knocked on the door. I heard her, but I still lay on my couch, sick with detoxing and so hungover, I couldn't possibly even get up. She knocked over and over again, and finally, I staggered to the door and flung it open. She said, "Oh my God, you've been drinking." She then fled. Rhonda, my wife, wanted me to cut back. She kept getting more insistent on doing so. So then first, I tried the controlled drinking model. I knew the literature said it wasn't very successful. "Okay, Rhonda, at the barbecue, I'm only going to have two beers." I'd be on beer number one, and one of the guys would just walk by and say, "Hey, here, Mike, here, try this new spice rum." Or, "Hey, Pond, you're the only one who didn't get a shooter. Push this one back." Rhonda then would cruise past, see the beer in my hand, and say, "Is that your first beer?" "Yes, it is, honey." But Rhonda was no fool. Over time, things got worse, and I began calling sick to work, telling my staff to cancel all my clients and reschedule. Just tell them I have the flu. I'm sick. So now I want to stop and do a little bit of reflection on what we have learned from the book so far. I noticed in some of the sections, Michael Pond was explaining, especially in this last part too, on the difficulties of quitting drinking when his drinking and alcohol use was so much a part of his life. He kind of went into like his family, his friends, his gatherings. He would go drinking out with the guys after like a hockey practice and then after his son's games. His whole social network, or at least most of it, was again geared around drinking. That's the same with a lot of people in our population too. You know, it's a type of gathering where we all get together and just have a good time. And that is a huge part of people's lives. So then when you give that up, what is your life going to look like now? you may say to yourself, oh God, if I go to the same events, you know, am I just going to be really bored? Am I not going to have a good time? Am I not going to be able to control myself? Am I just going to have a drink anyways? And then if I really need to quit, do I just quit all my friends? Am I going to be able to hang out with all my friends sober while they're out drinking in front of me? These are a lot of tough questions people ask, you know, when they're going through recovery treatment centers. You know, what's their life going to look like when it's over? What's their life going to look like with new friends? That right there in itself is scary. You know, how am I going to get sober friends? Am I going to have a good time with these new sober friends that I may or may not get? You also noticed in the book that he starts explaining when his life started getting a little out of control when it came to his drinking. Where earlier in his life, he was able to hold it down. You may call it a functioning alcoholic or a drinker, you know. Again, what is a functional substance abuser? Is it someone who can just still use drugs, drink on a regular basis, and take care of maybe the basic life like skills? Or they could, let's say, still pay the bills, keep a roof over their head, maintain a job, etc. Does that make them functioning? So going back to Michael, he starts explaining how his relationships were starting to be affected with his drinking. You know, his wife started to become upset. His practice started to suffer a little bit and so forth. So as we grow up in our communities, we often give names to people and their alcohol use. You know, a person could first say, oh, well, you know, I just don't drink at all. And then a person could just be a social drinker. They just drink on special events or, let's say, holidays. And then you could get into, let's say, a category of problematic drinking, where, let's say, okay, this person's drinking a lot and it's causing negative issues in their lives. But they, at the time of their lives, have no motivation to, let's say, get treatment or attempt to be in recovery. And then you'd most likely get into the phase of, okay, I have a lot of issues going on with this alcohol use, what should I do next? So again, this would be like after problematic drinking and the person has come into acceptance of their true issues regarding alcohol and they admit that they have a problem. So now I just feel like it would be a good idea for me to go over quickly the DSM-5 criteria for alcohol use disorder, just to give my listeners more education, and it also goes well with the book. So it begins with A, as in the use of alcohol to lead to alcohol use disorder, a problematic pattern of alcohol use leading to clinically significant impairment or distress that is manifested by at least two of the following are occurring within a 12-month period. So they give you like a list of symptoms that are going on. So the 12 begin with, okay, alcohol is often taking in large amounts over long periods of time than you originally intended. So it just keeps getting more and more and more over time. Next, there is a strong, persistent desire to stop or cut down drinking, and you, again, are failing to do so. Then, next one is a great deal of time is spent in the activities necessary to obtain alcohol or the use of alcohol or recover from its effects. And next is a craving or strong desire or urge to use alcohol. Then it is the recurrent alcohol use resulting in a failure to fulfill major role obligations in life, like work, school, and home. So going back to the functioning user. Then it is continued alcohol use despite having persistent or social interpersonal relationship issues. Kind of like going on and on again due to the use of drinking. Next would be important social, occupational, or recreational activities that are just given up because of the desire to use alcohol. So that's like, oh, instead of the hobbies that I used to love doing, I just don't do those anymore and I just stay home and drink. Then next would be the recurrent alcohol use in situations where it is physically dangerous. So driving under the influence is like an important example too of this. Then alcohol use is continued despite knowledge of having a persistent or recurrent physical or psychological issues. So that's like, you know, it's causing you like mental health issues, you know, it's causing you problems in your relationships, but you still use anyways. And then the next would be just increase tolerance over time, which is pretty common. And then a strong withdrawal period. So then now there is also three levels of severity to alcohol use. So out of the 12 that I just mentioned, a mild diagnosis would be just 2 to 3 of those symptoms. Then a moderate would be 4 to 5 of those symptoms. And then severe alcohol use disorder would be 6 or more that I just mentioned. Well, that is where I will end this episode today. So again, this episode was to give you some basic knowledge on the book and where it will be heading. So like I mentioned before, I'm not going to go over every single sentence in this book, but it is a great book and I highly recommend you all buying it, especially if you're a therapist or addiction counselor in the field or anyone working in the mental health addiction field. It is a great read. It really is. And I also have very special news. I was able to get Michael Pond as an interview guest coming up next Monday, April 11th at 6 p.m. So again, I'm very excited. And please, everyone, leave a comment in my inbox about any particular questions you want me to ask Michael Pond. Just again, about the book and his recovery, and I will make sure I bring it up into the interview. So I just want to thank all my BHI listeners for listening, and just know the information and content of this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you feel yourself dealing with any type of addiction issue or mental health issue, please seek the care of a licensed therapist or a medical doctor. All right, thank you and have a good day. Bye.